So it's a pleasure to welcome Changjing Wang to give a seminar for us today. Changjing is visiting PI until the end of next week.
I'm leaving on December 11th.
So for 10 days.
Yeah,
for
10 days.
For 10 days,
yeah.
Right? And he's a postdoc at the University of Chicago working with Mike Levin. He's going to tell us about work on gradient statistics of groups in 3D.
Okay. Thank you for the introduction. Okay, I'm very happy to have the opportunity to talk about my work with Michael Levin here today. So, the title of my talk today is Gradient Statistics of Loops in Three Dimensions. So, this talk is based on two works that I have done with Michael Levin. So, I would like to thank Michael for very pleasant collaboration, and also Chin-Hong Lin, who is a graduate student of Michael. We had lots of interesting discussions. So to talk about gradient statistics in three dimensions, let me first briefly review gradient statistics in two dimensions. So imagine you have a two-dimensional system. Imagine you have some two-dimensional system. Some two-dimensional system with some point-like particle excitations located somewhere in the system. Then you imagine adiabatically braid one particle, say here, alpha around beta. Then the alpha coming back to the original position. So you know that the wave function of the system, assuming that the state for this configuration of the particles is non-degenerate, then you know that the wave function will have some phase change. This phase change in general can depend on lots of things, depending on the dynamics or the geometry of the path. But there is a very important piece, that's the topological part of that phase, which only depend on the topology that you wind alpha around the beta or not, because this braiding process is actually topologically non-trivial. So this, in general, this topological part of the phase can be non-trivial, and we call this topological part is the braiding statistics. So in the case that this statistical phase is zero, that's the usual story of bosons and fermions. But if it's something non-zero between zero and 2 pi, this we call this statistics abelian statistics, and the associated particles are called abelian anions. If the state of the system for associated with this configuration is non-degenerate, then in general we get associated with this adiabatic braiding process, we have a unitary transformation, and these particles now are called non-abelian anions, and the statistics is the non-abelian statistics. And these two cases together are usually called fractional statistics. So this is a formal definition of gradient statistics. There are many systems that we can find these exotic gradient statistics. For example, the most famous one is the fractional quantum Hall systems. Like Laughlin state, it gave you these, you can find some abelian excitations with abelian statistics. More exotic ones like Mori-Read state, you can have non-abelian statistics. And also in some non-interacting systems, like some systems can be described by free fermion systems, like P plus IP superconductors. There are these Marana zero modes trapped in the vortex core of your system. They also exhibit non-abelian statistics. There are also like some exactly solvable models, like toric code, Levin-Wien models. They all have very interesting gradient statistics. Okay. This is a story about two-dimensional gradient statistics. Now let's go one-dimensional higher and ask a question, can we have fractional statistics in 3D? First, you may think of, can we have fractional statistics for particles? The answer is no, because the gradient process you do when you wind particle alpha around particle beta, the process itself is topologically trivial. So you cannot assign a braiding statistics, which is the topological part of the Barry phase, to a braiding process, which itself is trivial. So in order to define or find some fractional statistics, we first need to find some topologically non-trivial braiding process. So this is the place that where these loops enters the game. So indeed, we can find some braiding process which is non-trivial if you consider loops. So one example is here. You have a particle, and you wind around this loop in this way. This braiding process is non-contractible. You cannot contract this braiding process to nothing. So it's a topologically non-trivial braiding process. Another case is to consider two loops. You have one loop, say the first loop, shrink a little bit, then pass through the middle of the second loop, then expand a little bit, the first loop coming back to the original position. This process is also topologically non-trivial. So, okay, these are good braiding processes. So it is possible that we can find some non-trivial braiding statistics associated with these processes. Okay, this will be the topic of my talk today. But before I talk about that, maybe the first question you ask is, is it physical to talk about loops in real physical system? Yes, it is reasonable because there are actually many physical systems exhibiting these loop-like excitations. For example, vortices in classical fluids. So if you have some vortex which does not end at the surface of your system, it will eventually close. So it forms a loop-like object in your system. In more quantum mechanical systems, like vortices, you can see vortices in superfluids, in superconductors, and also line-like topological defects in broken symmetry phases. And also in gauge theories, you can consider flux loops. Okay, so it is indeed reasonable and physical to talk about loops in physical systems. So the particular system that I'm gonna talk about, which may acquire this loop-like excitation, is the so-called symmetry protected topological phase. So let me, okay. Most of you here probably are very familiar with what symmetry protected topological phase is because many people are working on this subject in parameter. So, but let me briefly review a little bit what symmetry protected topological phase is. So the most famous example nowadays should be topological insulators. Now consider a two-dimensional topological insulator here. It's some insulator, which means it's gapped in the bulk, but somehow you have some interesting boundary modes. These boundary modes are gapless, and you can never gap them out as long as you preserve the symmetry of the system, in this case, which is actually the U1 charge conservation and the time reversal symmetry. So if you want to, if you try to gap out the edge modes, you will end up with breaking one of these two, breaking the symmetry of the system. In contrast, there is the trivial insulator, which is also gapped in the bulk, but there's no symmetry protected boundary modes. Okay, another example is one-dimensional Houdin spin chain. You have somehow, due to some funny interaction in the bulk of the chain, you find at the end there are two-fold degeneracy at each end of the chain, which behave like some spin half system. And this two-fold degeneracy at the end can never be lifted. If you preserve the symmetry of the system, we are here, it's the SO3 rotational symmetry. So in contrast, there is also a regular spin one chain, which is trivial. That means you have no two-fold degeneracy at the end of the chain. So these are two examples. More formally, you can define some symmetry protected topological phase as Borian. It has some kind of Borian bulk, which means it's gapped. And the symmetry of this, you can define such SPT phases for general symmetry in general dimensions. And with a Borian bulk, that means it's gapped and no symmetry is broken, and the ground state is short range entangled. That means, okay, you can somehow do some unitary local transformation and so that it can be smoothly tuned to the direct product state. A non-example of this SPT phase is fractional quantum Hall system, because in fractional quantum Hall system, you have a fractional statistics. That means the system is not short-range entangled. You have some long-range entanglement between these in the system. But somehow, these SPT phases, they exhibit very interesting boundary. That's the protected gapless modes, as is shown in the previous slide by examples. So this is a formal definition of SPT phases. So in general, there are two kinds of questions we can ask. People can ask for these SPT phases. One is a classification question, another is a characterization question. Classification basically means you ask how many distinct SPT phases you can have. And this kind of question gave you, the final answer is some number, okay. So this classification has been done for many systems like non-interacting fermion systems by Kitaev, Schneider, and collaborators. And also in general boson systems, this is the work done by Zhen Chen and Xiaogang, the collaborators. They actually conjectured that for general boson systems with interaction, the SPT phases are classified by the group cohomology. That means they constructed some model, a class of models labeled by this mathematical object. And they claim that each model, each of these models belong to distinct phases, and there's no other phases beyond this class of examples. So, okay, in terms of characterization, you ask a question, okay, after suppose you are done with classification, you find some number, then you ask a physical question, what's the difference between these numbers? Okay, what's the physical property? So you can have different ways to probe the difference. For example, this boundary modes. But today I'm gonna talk about another way to characterize these SPT phases. That's by gauging the symmetry of the system and then study the emergent Brayton statistics. This is also work of Zhen Chen here. So what I mean by gauging a symmetry of this SPT phases? So technically it means that you have some global, you have a system which you have a global symmetry. You can always couple it to a gauge field so that global symmetry is promoted to a local gauge symmetry. If the symmetry is a continuum, you couple to a continuum gauge theory. If it's a discrete symmetry, you couple it to a discrete gauge theory. Okay, this is a technical definition, but I don't want to go into the technical details. I will show you that the main consequence after you gauging the symmetry is that there will be Brayton statistics emerge after you gauge the symmetry. So here is an example. Suppose we consider two-dimensional S-wave superconductor. In these systems, okay, we know that it's described by this BCS theory. You solve the quadratic BDG equation, you find the energy spectrum. And in this system, you have fermion parity because it's quadratic. You have this pairing term. So in such a system, you only have some neutral excitations plus single fermion excitations. Or there's no interest in non-trivial breeding statistics between these excitations. Now you couple to you gauge the fermion parity and promote this Z2 fermion parity into a Z2 gauge theory. Okay, after you gauge the symmetry, then you introduce new types of excitations in your theory. Besides the original neutral excitations and the single fermion excitations, now you introduce vortices in your system. There are two types of vortices. The second one is just a combination of the first one with a fermion, single fermion. Now you study the breeding statistics between these types of excitations, you find that non-trivial statistics appear. For example, this charge and this first type of vortices, you have a pi, you have a statistical phase pi, and this some other non-trivial breeding statistics. So this is the consequence after you gauge the symmetry, the main consequence. So, okay. Now you ask why we are care about this gauging symmetry. This is because the conjecture proposed by my supervisor and Zhen Chen here, they say that if you have different SPT phases, okay, with one certain symmetry, then you gauge the symmetry. You find that gauging the symmetry of different SPT phases leads to different different types of breeding statistics. Okay. This is a non-trivial statement. And it has been verified by various two-dimensional examples, but it's not clear that whether it's true in 3D or not. Okay.
So how about
It's weak. So actually there is a implicit assumption that we set the gauge coupling constant to, okay, let me see. So we actually assume that the gauge theory is deconfined. All the excitations are free to move. So you have all the charge excitations. But okay, this is the assumption behind it. I don't know. Time reversal is anti-unitary. I don't know how to. I don't know how to. I can only deal with internal symmetry, internal unitary symmetry. Okay, so the main body of my talk today is I will study this three-dimensional SPT phase with the particular symmetry Zn to the power k, and I will gauge the symmetry so that I study the emergent breeding statistics and verify if the conjecture that I mentioned in the previous slide is correct. But the first question you may ask is, what is the breeding statistics in three dimensions? As I raised in the, so actually I'm answering two questions at the same time. One is what's the correct, okay, what's the more interesting breeding statistics in three dimension that people can consider? Another is, okay, if we find these interesting breeding statistics, can these breeding statistics distinguish different SPT phases? So I'm answering the two questions at the once, okay. So let me be a bit more concrete by talking about some very general model. That is, I'm considering a three-dimensional lattice boson with Bn to the power k symmetry. Or more specifically, you can consider, okay, there are some three-dimensional lattice model. On each side, you have k species of bosons. But for each species of boson, the particle number is conserved only modulo n. Then you realize such a Zn to the k symmetry. And we assume that the Hamiltonian is such that the ground state becomes gapped and no symmetry is spontaneously broken and the ground state is short range entangled. Then we couple it to a Zn to the k lattice gauge field, which lives on the link of the lattice. Okay, after you do that, you will find that there are some emergent excitations, like charge excitations, loop excitations. They will exhibit very interesting braiding statistics. Okay, let me start with the excitation spectrum in such a general model. So since this, now after I gauge the symmetry, it becomes a gauge theory. So in such a gauge theory, we have two types of excitations. Okay, let me start with some abelian statistics so that we have a very clear picture of what the excitations are. So assuming abelian statistics, then the charge excitations are labeled by some integer vector, a k component integer vector, with each component takes values from 0 to n minus 1. These charge excitations correspond to the original, the local excitations in the original ungauged model, which are transformed according to different irreducible representation of your symmetry. So another type of excitation is you have a vortices in your system. They are actually string-like. And if these excitations don't end at the surface of your system, they form closed loop. These vortices, vortex loops, they carry gauge flux of your gauge theory. This gauge flux can be labeled by 2 pi over n times some integer. This integer vector, each component of integer vector takes values from 0 to n minus 1. More generally, actually, the charge can be attached to your vortex loop. So the complete spectrum in this system is you have n to the power 2k different excitations. You have a combination of these two. So this is the excitation spectrum. Now, with these excitations, we can study the braiding statistics between these excitations. Since we have charge and the vortex, so we can study charge statistics, charge vortex statistics. Here I call this vortex simply loop. And also the third one is loop statistics. To begin, let's consider charge. Okay. Since these charge excitations correspond to the local excitations in the original system, which are made out of boson and which is short range entangled. So the statistics between charges must be both bosonic. So the phase should always be braiding statistics, always be zero. The charge loop statistics is also simple. If you take some charge around the flux loop in this way, what you're gonna have is the usual Aronoff Baum phase. So in our case, for the gauge group to be Zn to the k, it's just as the charge vector dot product, the flux vector. The value is 2 pi over n times some integer. Now let's come to the third type. So we can consider loop statistics. Okay, the process that we can think of is you take this loop, shrink a little bit, okay. You shrink a little bit, then this alpha loop pass through beta, then you expand a little bit of alpha, then alpha come back to the original position. So you finish up this braiding process. Since this braiding process is topologically non-trivial, so you ask the question, what kind of braiding statistics can we assign to this braiding process? Okay, so to start, actually it's simpler to consider these special loops, which are neutral. That neutral loop, by neutral loop, I mean these loops you can actually create from the vacuum, or you can shrink it to a point and annihilate completely with nothing left in the space. So we'll consider such kind of neutral loops. So we now consider this braiding process, alpha pass through beta, then wind around beta. Okay, since we are only interested in the topological part of this, the barrier phase associated with this braiding process, we can change the path. Here, which is some kind of a two-dimensional surface. We can change the geometry of the surface. So let's shrink a little bit this path. So do the braiding process again. We know that the braiding statistics will not change. Now we can even do shrink the path further. We do it in this way. So alpha shrink, and since it's neutral, so we can completely annihilate it. And nothing is here, then alpha reappear on the other side of the loop. So now we actually here already decoupled alpha and beta. So basically we can shrink beta to nothing. So what I have done here is due to some kind of smooth deformation of the braiding process, we find that braid alpha around beta is actually equivalent as braid alpha around nothing. So that means for neutral loops, the statistical phase must be zero. Okay, with that, we can consider more general braiding statistics of some general loops which allow charge attachment. So now we again consider this two-loop braiding process. In this process, actually, you can decompose this braiding process, the braiding statistics into four parts. The charge of alpha around charge of beta, charge of alpha around flux of beta, flux of alpha around charge of beta, and flux of alpha around flux of beta. Four pieces. But we know that charge part is trivial, just a zero. Flux part, the neutral part, is also zero, as I argued in the previous step. So we find that the only non-trivial, there are only two non-trivial piece, that's the charge of alpha around flux of beta and the flux of alpha around charge of beta. But this is nothing but the Aronoff-Bohm phases, which eventually give you some 2 pi over n times some integer. So I have talked about three types of braiding statistics. Charge, all of them are boson. Charge loop satisfies certain Aronoff-Bohm, given by Aronoff-Bohm phase. Loop, given by Aronoff-Bohm phase. And these phases are interesting because they are fractional. They are 2 pi over n times some integer. But they are not interesting enough. The reason is these phases are completely fixed by the group of your gauge theory. No feature of the underlying, because remember our goal was to find some braiding process that can be used to distinguish different SPT phases. But all these statistics, they are fixed by the gauge group. That means no matter what SPT phase, SPT model you start with, you always end up with the same statistics of this type. So this motivates, that means we need a new type of braiding process which can tell you finer structure in this gauge theories, which can reflect the feature of SPT phase. So this motivates us to study this type of braiding statistics. Consider such a structure. You have a loop, gamma, and other two loops, alpha, beta. Alpha, beta are linked with gamma. Then alpha do a process similar in the two loop case. You alpha move forward and shrink a little bit, pass through beta, wind around beta, then come back to the original position. So we consider this type of three loop braiding process. And so three loop braiding process is interesting because the argument that I just used to show that this two neutral loop, they have trivial statistics, it's not working here because whenever you want to shrink alpha into nothing, then you want to annihilate it, you're always gonna touch beta. This is not allowed because in any braiding process, you cannot bring two excitations close. Otherwise, you introduce this interaction between these contact interaction between the excitations. This is not allowed in the definition of braiding statistics. So that means this three-loop braiding process is less constrained than the two-loop braiding process. Okay, less constrained means it may provide more information than the two-loop braiding process. Okay, so it may be more interesting, but how can we study this three-loop braiding process? We find that actually it's simpler to start with statistics of unit fluxes. By unit flux, I mean you have some vortices, three loop. Each of them carry a flux, 2 pi over n. Phi I means the flux with only the ith entry to be 1. All other entries are 0. So we have three vortices. One carries flux phi I, second carry phi j, third carry a flux of phi k. So if you want to consider more general the statistics of other vortices carrying multiple of unit fluxes, you find that at the end they are just a linear combination of these statistics of these unit fluxes. We also find that it's actually more it's very convenient to define a quantity. We call it capital theta ijk, which is just n times of this little theta. This little theta is the statistical phase associated with this braiding process. But we multiply by n. N is this zn to the k, this n. So we define this capital theta. Why we want to define this is in this case, I only specified the flux of these vortex excitations. But we can, in general, attach some charge to the vortices. But after I define this capital theta multiplied by n, then this quantity has an interesting property. It's independent of charge attachment. If you attach some charge, then you know this little theta gonna be changed. So the change of this little theta is some Aronoff-Bohm phase, which is always 2 pi over n times some integer. So since here I multiply this little theta by n, so whenever you want to attach some charge, this n will cancel this effect. So this capital theta is insensitive to charge attachment. So we define this interesting quantity, capital theta. And you eventually will find that this capital theta is already interesting enough that it carries lots of information about the underlying gauge theory. So what property does this capital theta satisfy? So we find that there are some constraints it should satisfy. First of all, it's symmetric in the first two indices. This is easy to understand. You have you braid a flux phi I around another flux phi j is the same as you braid a phi j around phi I. So just the usual, it's very similar to 2D. Theta alpha beta is theta beta alpha. But it's also interesting to find that this capital theta is quantized. It's 2 pi over n times some integer. Remember this little theta, which is this capital theta divided by n. So if this capital theta is quantized as 2 pi over n times integer, little theta should be 2 pi over n squared times some integer. So, okay, let me show you, okay, this actually is a quantization condition is actually easy to prove by such a thought experiment. So imagine we have this setup with a base loop which carries a unit flux phi k, and we have n identical vortices. They carry, or each of them carry a unit flux phi j. We have n of them. Then imagine we have another vortex which carries a unit flux phi I. Then we do the braiding process. This phi I pass through all of them, wind around all these n unit fluxes. So we know that, okay, so the total phase should be n times this little theta I jk. The reason is you braid alpha around everything. It's the same as you braid around them individually for n times. Okay, so for each, if you braid phi I around one phi j, you got little theta I jk. So you braid n of them, you get n theta I jk. But interestingly, this whole thing, like n unit fluxes, you can fuse them. And That means this n-unit flux as a whole, actually, they carry 2-pi flux. But 2-pi flux is just nothing. So that means this a bunch of things. It's some extended object which carries no flux. That means it's a charge. Okay, so that means this process I'm considering here is I'm doing some process that use a flux wind around some extended charge. So that phase must also be given by the area of Bohm law. So it's some charge which we don't know times the flux of this vortex. So it's 2-pi over 2-pi over n times some integer. So these two ways of computing the total phase should be the same. So that means we have n e theta little theta ijk equals 2-pi over n times some integer. So remember the definition of capital theta is just this part. So we got this conclusion. Capital theta ijk is 2-pi over n times some integer. Okay, so I've proved the second constraint that this capital theta is quantized at the value 2-pi over n times some integer. Actually, you find that this capital theta also satisfies another constraint, this a cyclic identity, but it's more technical to prove such a constraint. Some kind of, if you, okay, but to physically prove them, it's kind of related to Jacobian identity, but that means you need some field theory description and quantize the theory, but I don't know yet. So we can prove that, but it's too technical, so I'm not showing you here. So with this, actually there are more constraints on this capital theta. If we define a similar quantity exchange statistics, now you consider exchange, you have a base loop and two identical loops linked with the base loop. You can exchange them. Like 2D, what you do, you introduce this exchange statistics of two identical vortices, both of them carrying a unit flux phi I. So you can define exchange statistics and multiply it by n. You can define some quantity, capital theta ik. But it's so if you define such quantity, then you have more constraint. So, but anyway, I have introduced this three loop rating process and some quantity, capital theta. They are kind of interesting. We find that they are constrained, but less constrained than the two loop operating process. Because for example, here, this integer can be any integer between zero to n. So that means it's plausible that this quantity, maybe we can use this three loop rating process to distinguish different SPT phases. Okay, so in order to make that statement, we need to go to explicit computation of these three loop rating process. So the explicit computation that we do is on these exactly soluble models constructed in this paper by Zhen Chen, Xiaogan, and in 2001. So we go to these models. They are exactly, the good point is these models are exactly soluble. So we want to find this three loop rating process in these models and to see if this three loop rating process is interesting enough or not.
Can you explain why
theta ij in ij is because in 2D, you know, it's a very analogous to 2D. In 2D, you define some rating process, alpha, beta, alpha around beta. So you define some statistical phase, theta alpha beta. You can also do the same thing. So if you do a braiding process, okay, it's this way, beta alpha. So you define this theta beta alpha. But in space time, this one is just, okay, you have this kind of topology. In this case, you have, so this is alpha, beta. You can smoothly deform the two passes in space-time. They are topologically equivalent. So that means you've got theta alpha, beta equals theta beta alpha. But here, it's similar.
But in the 3D case,
yeah.
Alpha, beta, alpha goes through beta inside.
Yeah.
For beta, alpha, beta goes outside.
No, it's the same. You still can define some right-handedness and left-handedness. So you always do the alpha beta in the space. You define some right-handed way, you find that they are the same.
The same, it doesn't matter whether it winds from inside out or outside
in. No, it's you define here is clockwise or counterclockwise. Okay. So in 3D, you can also define these two things. If you they are the same, that means both of them are right-handed, then they are the same. If one is right-handed, another is left-handed, they differ by a minus sign, like what you do here in 2D.
You get only one cross-section like that, because it's extended.
Yeah. If you see the cross-section, then you see actually if you have a plane cross the loops, you have two passes on this. The plane, one is right-handed, another is left-handed, so they always appear at the same time. But okay.
Are you talking about the same? I'm not sure you're talking about the same.
I mean, it's similar. Yeah.
I'm not sure his question, but what data were you talking about in your question?
His question was property, the first property, why it's symmetric in the first two indices. I mean, it can be proved in a similar way as you prove
what
it for 2D.
Does that first one represent, say, the ij comma j?
Uh-huh.
Which process does it represent?
Oh, okay, this process represents here. You have a unit flux base loop, you wind phi i around phi j in this right-hand way, okay, left right-handed way, then you can do a similar thing like phi j around the phi I and also in a right-handed way. This is theta j I. Okay. So now I want to, I have defined these quantities. I want to compute this three-loop braiding process in some explicit models. So we go to this group cohomology models. So what we do here is we take these exactly soluble model from this paper, but with let's be simpler first to consider Zn to the power 2 and take this model. It has this symmetry. So according to the conjecture in this paper, that these models are actually labeled by this group cohomology, which is in this case Zn squared, and the conjecture is that they believe that all these models, these n squared models, they all belong to distinct SPT phases. So now we take this model, let's couple it to the n squared lattice gauge field, and we extract the three loop braiding process that I just introduced. Since this model actually is exactly soluble model, we managed to find out this three loop braiding process. Through some computation, after some computation, you find the end result is like that. This capital theta that I just defined, in this case, this ijk, because k is just a 2, so each index takes values from 1 to 2. So you have actually 8 components of this three index tensor. So these eight components, they take values like this. And also another quantity theta ik, the exchange statistics, takes values like this. So there are two free parameters, p1, p2, they are integers. And you find that these n squared different group cohomology models, they give rise to this n different types of braiding statistics. So that means since these braiding statistics, they are discrete set of data, so that means the original SPT models, they must belong to different phases because they cannot be smoothly connected with each. Because you have these discrete data, they can never change when you smoothly tune the Hamiltonian. So this kind of verifies the conjecture that indeed these n squared different models, they belong to n squared different phases. Okay. Now we can go to more general SPT model with a general K. We can repeat the previous procedure. We take this group cohomology model with this Zn to the K symmetry, coupled to a Zn to the k lattice gauge field, we extract the three-loop braiding process. It's, again, it's exactly soluble, but there is a complication because you find that non-abelian statistics will appear if k is bigger than 4, bigger or equal than 4. So up to now, I have assumed the abelian statistics. All what I was telling you was assuming abelian statistics. So how can we deal with this k bigger than 4k? What's the non-abelian statistics? In what sense I mean non-abelian loop braiding statistics? OK. Let me point out that actually the three-loop braiding process that I just introduced has a very similar structure as 2D braiding process. So in 2D, you know that usually the story is we line up all these anions, then introduce some kind of fusion space. So two anion alpha beta, they can be in certain fusion channel delta. There is a fusion space associated with this. Maybe it's some multidimensional, probably multidimensional fusion space. Then if you exchange the position of alpha beta, you can define some R symbol, which is the unitary map between the fusion space of alpha beta in fusion channel delta and the fusion space of beta alpha in fusion channel delta. So for experts, you know that you can also define this F symbol, which describes different ways to fuse the particles, but it's irrelevant in my talk today. So I'm going to tell you about this R symbol. Actually, the three-loop braiding process has a similar structure. So I have a base loop. You can close this gamma here. But for clearness, I'm just showing you a line here. So you can have a bunch of loops linked with gamma. Now you can define similar structure, like a fusion space, alpha, beta. Now here, alpha, beta means some loop. Alpha, beta in some fusion channel delta. And you can define some R symbol. The only difference here is in 2D, OK, this fusion space, there's the whole story. But here, everything should depend on the flux of the base loop. OK. So that means for each base loop, you have some kind of two-dimensional world. You can define the fusion space, the R symbol, everything. And you may have some unitary matrix, which is a not one-dimensional object. So you can define some non-abelian statistics for the non-abelian loop braiding statistics. OK, this is a concept about non-abelian loop braiding. However, I think this R matrix is too complicated. I don't want to go too far into this R matrix. So we find actually we don't have to deal with this R matrix, this matrix. We find instead that we can define some quantity called topological invariance. Okay, I give them some names so that, and these quantities are this capital theta ij, capital theta ijk, capital theta ijkl. I'm using the same symbol as I was using in the abelian case, where I define capital theta ij, k, and capital theta ij in that case. Here, I'm using the same symbol because once I give you the definition of this topological invariance, in the case of non-abelian statistics, you will find that these first two, they reduce this to the original definition if you assume abelian statistics. And but there is a new quantity which actually characterize the non-abelian nature of these statistics.
This is short-range
entangled state. Then I gauge it, you become, you have a non-abelian, you have a loop, non-trivial braiding statistic.
Can you explain
how that happened? So in any gauge theory, you have a charge, like a discrete gauge theory. After you have some charge, then charge must have. Yeah, abelian gauge theory. Then you find that it's quite interesting. Even in abelian gauge theory, you will have non-abelian statistics. That's yes. This group cohomology in 2D, you have 3Z, Z, the simplest example, Z2 cross Z2 cross Z2. If you only have Z2Z, there's no such non-abelian statistics. But if you go to 3, then you have non-abelian statistics. In 3D, you have to go to 4. For Z2. So I want to define these quantities. So actually, let me just give you the definition. So let's consider this three loop setup. So the definition of this capital theta ijk is now just you wind, you do this braiding process, but you continuously wind phi I wind around the beta for n times, then at the end come back to the original position. This is defined in the case that it can be non-abelian or abelian. So you can prove actually this kind of braiding process actually is some kind of matrix raised to power n, certain power n. You can prove in abelian gauge theory, if you raise this matrix, braiding matrix in to the power n, it's always an abelian phase times some identity matrix. In general, we can prove that. And very interestingly, not only is just an abelian phase, but also this capital theta is the function of the flux of these excitations only. That means you can attach some charge, even in a non-abelian case. This capital theta is independent of charge attachment. So just a reminder that in the abelian case, if you wind n times, that means it's just the n times the little theta ijk. This agrees our my previous definition in the abelian case. So this defines this capital theta in the general case. And it has very nice property. It's abelian phase. So we don't have to go to this matrix, which is quite complicated. So this is the definition of this capital theta ijk. Now there is a new quantity, capital theta ijkl. It's defined in a similar way. It's some braiding process. You first, you have alpha, beta, eta. All of them are linked with the base gamma. So the braiding process you're gonna do for this invariant is you first wind, okay, follow the blue line. You wind, alpha is braided around the beta. So let's say this is right-hand way. Then around the eta, also in a right-hand way. Now you follow the red line. You do the braiding alpha around beta in a left-hand way, okay, if you can define, then left-hand way. So this actually, this process can be described by full matrix. You have B alpha, beta, alpha, and B alpha, alpha beta, alpha eta, then the inverse of this alpha beta. So it's actually some commutator. You also can prove that this commutator is always an abelian phase for abelian gauge theory. And it has a very interesting property that it only depends on the fluxes of all these four vortices. It's independent of charge attachment. So since this is a commutator, you know that in the abelian case, there is no such quantity, the commutator, just the one. So I have defined these quantities. I claim that they are interesting enough. So let's do an explicit example. Consider the case k equals 4. This is the smallest k in these group cohomology models that non-abelian statistics can appear. So the group cohomology models with this kind of symmetry, you compute this group, cohomology group, you find that there are n, z, it's the number, this group is zn to the power 19. So that means there are n to the power 19 different models. So according to the conjecture of Zhen Chen and Shogun's paper, there are n to the, these models, they all belong to different phases. So they should be the same. Okay, now let's apply the previous procedure. We coupled to gauge field, extracted the three loop statistics, but now we focus on this very interesting quantity, this capital theta I. Okay, I didn't explain you what this capital theta ij is in the non-abelian case because it's very complicated. And there is, but if you believe me, because I already gave you some concrete definition of these two quantities, there is also a concrete definition of a capital theta ij. So you find that these three, the first tensor, there are 12 independent components. And this capital theta ijk, there are 6 independent components. And ijkl, there are only 1 independent component. And each of the component takes values from 0, 2 pi over n, 2 pi over n times 2, up to 2 pi over n, n minus 1. So each of them takes values in this. So since there are 19 independent entries of these three tensors, so that means there are n to the power of 19 different combinations, different types of braiding statistics, which actually correspond to these n to the 19 different models. Again, these are, since these are a discrete set of data, they cannot change if you smoothly deform the Hamiltonian. So that means, indeed, all these models, they belong to distinct phases. And interestingly, these quantities, the invariance that I just defined, is able to distinguish these different phases. OK, and in general, if you go to general K, this, again, works. What theta? This one is special case of it.
I mean, the first.
Oh, the first two.
Is some special case.
No, it's a if you have I equals say, okay, j equals k and I equals j. So that means you consider theta I j. It's actually in the way that I define them. It's actually twice of this. So this is actually some kind of exchange statistic.
Yeah,
they are related. So there are some constraints between them. But this one contains more information. Then if you only define theta IIJ, it contains less information than this quantity. This quantity, in order to distinguish all these models, you have to go to this. IJI is related to IIJ. There is a constraint between them. There is some kind of symmetry, like the cyclic identity. So, okay, let me conclude. What I have talked about today was I want to study this three loop braiding, want to study braiding statistics of loops in three dimensions. I introduced this concept of three loop braiding process and find that this three loop braiding process, yes, it's indeed, it's interesting enough because it can distinguish these different group cohomology models. And in particular, I introduced these topological invariants, which is a subset of the total braiding, the whole set of braiding statistics, which are some matrix. But these topological invariants are some abelian phase. These topological invariants is also able to distinguish different phases. So second point is that we, using these braiding statistics, using these invariants, we confirmed that indeed each of the group cohomology models, they belong to a distinct phase, okay? So this braiding process is some kind of way to distinguish different models. Actually, it can go beyond group cohomology models. Group cohomology models are defined in terms of these explicit models. But if you go to, say, you ask a question, for a given macroscopic Hamiltonian, what phase it belongs to? You can't go to group cohomology because there's no group cohomology for a general macroscopic Hamiltonian. But you do have braiding statistics for general Hamiltonian. You can gauge it, and you study braiding statistics. So these quantities give you some kind of physical interpretation of what these some physical way to probe these SPT phases. Okay. Let me at the end talk about some open questions. So today I focused on gauge theories with abelian gauge group. In general, you can go to. So there is a question: how can we describe general loop braiding statistics in non-abelian gauge theories, and even beyond the gauge theories, like in 2D, not every statistics can be described by gauge theory. There are some more general descriptions. So in 3D, is that case? Or is the gauge theory the whole story? And even you can ask a more ambitious question. Can we have some general algebraic description of loop fusion and braiding? Another question. I've talked about, the whole talk is about boson SPT phases, but what about fermion systems? What kind of interesting structure can emerge in these gauged fermionic SPT systems? And also, I'm using this lattice gauge language, but do we have a field theory description? And also, I focused on these braiding statistics in the bulk of the three-dimensional system. like in 2D, we always emphasize the edge bulk correspondence. You have some Brady statistics in the bulk, then you have some edge mode. But here in 3D, you can ask a similar question. Since now you have a loop rating in the bulk, is there any relation between the boundary theory and the loop rating in the bulk? So of course, all these are theoretical considerations. Then you ask a question. How can we realize them in experimental system? And in particular, how to detect them? Like in 2D, if you have some grading statistics, you use interferometer, different kind of interferometer to detect these statistics. But in 3D, what can we do with these loop grading statistics? And how to detect them? OK, with that, I would like to thank for your attention. OK, thank you.